Welcome to the Movement Church Podcast. Our vision is to be a movement of people finding their way back to God. For more information about Movement Church, including attending a worship experience, getting connected, or to give online, please visit movementcolumbus.com.
There it is, that wonderful commercial that we start every week with. I just love the phrasing of some of that. I love the Game of Life logo that it says, a family game, because that's the heart of this series. Obviously, we don't know what life will bring us. We don't know exactly what life is going to look like, and yet often it involves family and people close to us. Often it involves people that are family. Sometimes we're excited that we're there. Sometimes they're the ones making our lives complicated. And so that's the heart of this series. And I'm excited to jump into week two of this. My name is Mark. If I haven't said that, I have the privilege of being the lead pastor here. And we want to just jump into our passage this week because, like I said, I'm excited what God has to teach us. And so whether you knew it or not, you sat down close to a Bible. There may be a Bible under your seat. There might be one around you. Maybe you brought one. Maybe you have one on your phone. But we are going to be in Hebrews chapter 12 today on page 927. And if you don't have a copy of the Bible, if you don't have a copy of God's Word, I would love for you to take that Bible home. That is yours to keep, and you can study that. You can look at that. That is our gift to you because we believe that reading that during the week has value. But we're going to be on page 927 in Hebrews chapter 12, looking at the game of life together. And I promise it will not be as annoying as that commercial, like we said. That song's going to be stuck in your head all week. I apologize for that. Now that I think about it, it was a terrible idea. We should have never played that. But let's jump into Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1 here and read this together. We can follow along. It says this. It says, therefore. Now, if you've studied the Bible, you know, maybe you've heard this phrase. I know we got one word in and we stopped, right? Isn't that weird? Therefore, it says, now, someone's probably told you this. If there's a therefore, you need to figure out what the therefore is there for, right? And so we made it one word in. I know we're going to go on a small rant here, but it says, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a huge crowd of witnesses to the life of faith. This is written to the church. This is written to believers. This is written to an audience like us. And it says, therefore. So what is that therefore, therefore? Well, the chapter before this, Hebrews 11, is a very famous chapter. It's a chapter that's kind of called the Hall of Faith, and it references some people who are a big deal in the Bible, people who are a big deal in the Old Testament world. And so here's the people it's referencing. You can turn back if you want, and you can look at Hebrews 11, but this is what that therefore is there for. This is the huge crowd of witnesses it's talking about. It says, faith is the confidence that we hope for, that what we hope for will actually happen. It gives us assurance about things we cannot see. Through their faith, the people in days of old, talking about the Old Testament, earned a good reputation. By faith, we understand that the entire universe was formed at God's command. That what we now see did not come from anything that can be seen. And it goes on to reference these people, this cloud of witnesses, this hall of faith, hall of fame. And it says, it was by faith that Abel brought a more acceptable offering to God than Cain did. It was by faith that Enoch was taken up to heaven. Verse 7, it was by faith that Noah built a large boat. Verse 8, it was by faith that Abraham obeyed when God called him. Verse 11, it was by faith that Sarah was able to have a child. Verse 13, all of these people died still believing what God had promised them. They did not receive what was promised, but they saw it all from a distance and welcomed it. Verse 17, it was by faith that Abraham offered Isaac as a sacrifice when God was testing him. Verse 20, it was by faith that Isaac was promised blessings. Verse 21, it was by faith that Jacob, when he was old and dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and bowed in worship as he leaned on his staff. Verse 22, it was by faith that Joseph, when he was about to die, said confidently that the people of Israel would leave Egypt. Verse 23, it was by faith that Moses' parents hid him for 3 months when he was born. Verse 27, it was by faith that Moses left the land of Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. Verse 30, it was by faith that the people of Israel marched around Jericho for 7 days. Verse 31, it was by faith that Rahab the prostitute was not destroyed with the people in her city who refused to obey God. Verse 32, how much more do I need to say? It would take too long to recount the stories of the faith of Gideon, of Barak, of Samson, of Jephthah, of David, of Samuel, and all the prophets. By faith, these people overthrew kingdoms, ruled with justice, and received what God had promised them. They shut the mouths of lions, quenched the flames of fire, and escaped death by the edge of the sword. Their weakness was turned to strength. They became strong in battle and put whole armies to flight. Verse 39, chapter 11. All these people earned a good reputation because of their faith, yet none of them received all that God has promised. For God had something better in mind for us so that they would not reach perfection without us. And so all of these people in chapter 11, as we look back, they're being celebrated. They're saying, these are people you can look up to. And you know this, right? Because some of you have heard these stories. You used to go to a Sunday school class, and an old woman with a chain on her glasses would put a flannel graph up and do all these stories and move around little characters. And so you know the story of Noah, and you know the story of Abraham, and you were in Sunday school, and your grandma read you these stories, and you and your brothers and sisters used to talk about them. You know that these people operated by faith, and they didn't just have this mental faith. But their faith led to their actions and led to a belief that would actually drive them and cause their lives to look differently, right? And that's what this chapter is celebrating. It's saying, now these people had faith in what God was doing, and yet they didn't get to see the completion of God's final plan. They knew the Messiah was coming. They knew something big, something great was coming, but they didn't get to see it. And so the reason that it's referencing back, it's saying, hey, those people had faith. They're an example for you. They trusted what God was about to do. We, as the modern day church, have seen what God did. We see that he sent his son Jesus. We see that we have life in him. And we see that that's a big deal. And so getting back to the therefore of the therefore and what it's there for, therefore, right? It's saying, since you have that example, since you've seen the Old Testament and you've seen how these people operated on faith and they didn't even have the whole story, you have the whole complete story. You have Noah, you have Abraham, you have Isaac, you have all of the disciples, you have the life and ministry of Jesus, you have the Old Testament, you have the New Testament, you're surrounded by a cloud of great witnesses and an example of faith, and that should push you forward. So there's a little backdrop for this passage. Here's what it goes on and continues to say. Right? We know that it said that. Therefore, since we're surrounded by such a huge cloud of witnesses, it says, let us strip off every weight that slows us down. Especially the sin that so easily trips us up, and let us run with endurance the race that God has set before us. Let us strip off every weight that slows us down. So we have this cloud of witnesses. We've seen a full picture of what God has done. And admittedly, I think the author of this passage is saying, listen, you should be motivated, you should be pushed, you should be inspired. Some of you aren't running like you should be. Maybe there's something that's weighing you down, something that's holding you back, something that's just kind of keeping you from being who you could be. Some of you have been around long enough that you've noticed that America loves workout fads, right? Maybe you remember Suzanne Summer from Three's Company doing that thing that you would squeeze. What was it called? The Thigh Master? I don't know what it's called. Yeah. Or maybe you've been around. Maybe you have a copy of P90X. Maybe it worked for you, or maybe you just bought it and put it in your closet. Maybe you have like a Nordic Track rowing machine. One of the things that I fell victim to, I wanted these the whole time I was growing up. Luckily, my parents wouldn't let us get them. There were these shoes called strength shoes, and they were supposed to make you awesome at basketball and able to dunk. And basically, they were like a 6-inch platform heel, like the Spice Girls used to wear, right? Except they just like cut the heel off. And so you would just be walking on the balls of your feet, and you were supposed to do this whole workout, and magically it would just give you gigantic calf muscles, and you'd be able to dunk, right, if you had those shoes. Well, that was something I wanted. My dad one day was like, you want strong calves? I'll give you strong calves. And so he had these things, these ankle weights, right? They would just like Velcro around your ankles, and he's like, when you take those off, you'll feel light as a feather. Just do some workouts in those. And so we lived out in the country. We lived on a gravel road. We lived at the top of a hill. And so every time I ran, I would run down the hill. And so this is one of the workout fads I fell victim to. But I would go running in the summer, sometimes like the hottest part of the day. And I would run the last mile up a hill with these ankle weights, you know, and just like barely able to move my feet. And they were so heavy that sometimes they wouldn't just hold my feet back. That even as I would get my feet going, the weight would like throw my feet forward. And they would, they'd almost bring me to the ground. But my dad was right. When I took those things off, I could feel a difference, right? My hip was out of socket, but I could feel a difference. And it felt really, really good. I felt really light. And I'm like, I can run. I can do this. And so that's what this passage is saying. It's saying there's some things that are holding you back. There's some things that are throwing off how you're supposed to run, how you're supposed to act, what your faith is supposed to look like, what your practice, what your belief, what your actions are supposed to look like. You're not there. Because you need to strip off this weight. You need to strip off this encumbrance. You need to get rid of these things that so easily trip you up. We're supposed to run. We were created to run. You were created to run. We don't often realize that. God created us to run after him. And this passage says, get rid of the things that are holding you back. Get rid of the things that are weighing you down. Get rid of the things that are in the way and run with endurance. So sometimes we get excited about running. Some of you have probably been to a track meet or been in a track meet, and there's always that one kid that took off way too soon in the 2 mile, right? And he was leading for just the first lap, and then at the end he'd be like on the side heaving, and you're like, started off too fast, buddy, right? This passage is saying, listen, you need to run with endurance. So you need to run knowing that life is tough, knowing that life and people and things and unexpected things are going to get in the way and are going to attack you and are going to drag you down. You need to get rid of sin and you need to run, but you need to run with some wisdom. You need to run so that you can keep up that pace, so that you can run after God and run as he has created you to run. Run with endurance. So how do we do that? Verse 2. We do this by keeping our eyes on Jesus. You were created to run, and you can't run toward Jesus if you don't have your eyes on Jesus. I mean, if I were to say right now, everyone stand up, close your eyes, and run toward me, we'd probably get sued, right? By many of you, even though you seem like great people, right? You'd be tripping over each other, running into people, tripping over chairs, tripping over cords. It's a terrible idea. You can't run as you were created to run if something is weighing you down. You can't run as you were created to run if you don't have some endurance and some discipline. And you can't run as you were created to run if you take your eyes off of Jesus. But that sounds really cute, right? Run and keep your eyes on Jesus. What does that mean? This verse goes on to say this. We do this by keeping our eyes on Jesus, the champion who initiates and perfects our faith. So why does Jesus matter? Not because people make bracelets about him. And not because there are t-shirts with him giving two thumbs up, right? Jesus matters because he initiates our faith. We are so lost, so down and out without him, that he actually is the one who grows a faith in him inside of us. He draws us and calls us to himself. And so any good thing that we think we've done, even our belief in him, he planted a seed and said, believe in me. And so he initiates our faith in him. That is why Jesus is a big deal. Can anyone else in the room initiate faith in themselves? No, the answer is no. That was rhetorical, but let me just go ahead and say it, right? Jesus is the initiator of faith, and yet he perfects our faith. And so as we have imperfections, he changes those. He transforms us. He morphs us. He lets us believe in him, and not just believe in him, but he takes us from a weak faith and he gives us an update. He takes us from a faith that's underdeveloped and he makes it strong and fully developed, able to believe in him and able to run after him. So keep your eyes on Jesus, because he has initiated your faith and will continue to perfect your faith. How does Jesus do that? Some of us know the gospel, but these verses go on and say this, and I think this is a beautiful thing to hear. Because of the joy awaiting him, he endured the cross, disregarding its shame. Now he is seated in the place of honor beside God's throne. We were created to know God. We were created to run after God, and sin in our lives separates us from God. Takes us out of relationship with God and puts a gap between us and God. Jesus came out of love, out of grace that we don't deserve, came to this world, lived a perfect life, and when he was crucified on the cross, he went to the cross to take the shame and guilt and weight of our sins that separate us from God and our sins that keep us from God. It says, because of the joy awaiting him, his love for us gives him joy. And now that he's seated next to God the Father, there is joy in his heart. And by the death and burial and resurrection of Jesus, we are given life in him. When we believe in him, when we trust in him, when we follow our lives after him, and when we live our lives for him, we are found in him. Says that the sin that Jesus took on himself, there was shame involved, but he disregarding its shame, and now he's seated in a place of honor beside God's throne. Because sometimes, let's be honest, we get weighed down by life and by stuff, and we think, well, I'm glad that Jesus has joy, but I don't really feel joy right now. I'm having some trouble running, and these things are holding me down, and I love what this next verse says. Verse 3 says, think of all the hostility he endured from sinful people. then you won't become weary and give up. And so as we run toward God, as we keep our eyes on God, as we keep our eyes on Jesus, as we look after him, as we run after him, we should let Jesus' sacrifice and joy be our example. He didn't think, I don't know if I want to die for these people. I feel like they don't really appreciate it. Some of them aren't even going to realize what I've done. I mean, I'm the Son of God. This is a big deal. You're pretty lucky. No, he just went and did what he felt called to do. He did it to save us, and he did it even when we didn't deserve it. Verse 4 says, after all, you've not yet given your lives in your struggle against sin. So we like to think that life is pretty tough. We're playing the game of life. We roll the dice, and our little brother says, you just lost your job. You just had twins. You got a raise. Something you didn't expect happens, right? This week, some things in our lives happened that we didn't expect. Some people in our lives ticked us off and hurt us. And this sinful, broken world is a struggle and is difficult. And yet, this verse is kind of keeping it all where our thoughts should be, right? It's keeping us in perspective. And it's saying, you haven't lost your life yet in this struggle for sin in this life. So what Jesus has done is greater. And yet, up to this point, this passage could kind of be like a pep talk, right? I mean, if you've never read the Bible, you could be like, so when he says run, is he like a track coach on the side? Or what's this? Why does the redhead guy keep saying running? That feels good. We're just like, run, have joy, run, run toward Jesus. Yay. Run. Feels good, right, to say that. And yet there's some background here, some things that we haven't thought about. I feel like the author of Hebrews, which is debated, we won't get into that discussion today, right? Many of us would think it was Paul, but we won't say if it was, right? Because some of you have other opinions. So we'll just say the author of Hebrews and keep us all happy. But I feel like this author is saying, as you look at your life, as you look at the reason you can't run, as you look at the thing that's holding you back, as you look at the reason that you don't have joy, and you look at the reason that your walk or your run or your relationship with Jesus has been held back and has been slowed down and has been kind of in a funk, Most of us look at that relationship and we know the thing that should be changed. God in some way has put that in our heart. He's spoken that to us. Maybe he's had someone in our life say something to us. Maybe someone close to us, maybe a sibling, maybe our parents. Maybe we're the parents that have said that to someone. But usually in some way, we're aware of the things that are slowing us down. We're aware of the things that are holding us back, and we're aware of the ways that God is in some way beginning to put discipline into our life. But usually we're not too pumped about that. And so I feel like this passage goes on to address that. Verse 5 says this, and have you forgotten the encouraging words God spoke to you as his children? He said, and don't give up when he corrects you. It says, my child, don't make light of the Lord's discipline and don't give up when he corrects you. So sometimes God is incorporating discipline into our lives. He's spoken something into us. He's saying, this is something I need you to fix. This is something that's holding you back. He sent some people to say those things. And instead of hearing those things, we get mad at the messenger, right? We get mad at the person that said that. They say, hey, I'm worried about you. And we think, well, your life isn't all together, so why would I even listen to you? Or our parents say, hey, have you ever thought of, and you think, listen, you were a terrible parent, so this really doesn't apply to me. Or our siblings say, hey, have you, and you think, you don't have it all figured out. We grew up in the same house. Or God puts something in our heart or speaks something into us, or as we're spending time in prayer, he says, this is something I want you to think about, and we don't think about it for a few reasons, but one of them, it says, sometimes people take the Lord's discipline light. And so maybe we had a crazy, crazy weekend. We've all heard stories of people waking up and not remembering what went on in their weekend. Or maybe you were almost in a car wreck. Or maybe something crazy happened. And we just think, whew, I won't do that again. And yet maybe that's God beginning to put discipline in your life and saying, hey, you need to wake up. I'm trying to get your attention. Sometimes we take the Lord's discipline lightly. It says, my child, don't make light of the Lord's discipline. And don't give up when he corrects you. Some of us take the Lord's discipline light. And some of us just take it on like this huge weight, like, oh, God put this on my heart. He's telling me I need to change. That's because I'm worthless. I've always been worthless. I'll never be good enough. I don't even know where to start. We can't take God's discipline lightly, and yet we can't let it be this burden that we can't overcome, because the point of it is this. Verse 6, for the Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes each one that he accepts as a child. And so no matter what you're tempted to think, you might not want to listen, or maybe you're taking it on and you've got this weight in your heart because God's starting to say something to you. We need to accept his discipline, and we need to understand something about his discipline. That discipline is love. No matter what you've been taught in America, no matter how we're conditioned to think that if a teacher yells at you in the middle of class, you should hate them for life and go to rate my professor and give them a bad recommendation and never again look them in the eye, right? We're told that if our parents discipline us, that we're supposed to turn against them for at least like 6 months growing up and talk terrible about them to our friends. We don't like discipline, right? But we have to retrain our thinking because this passage is saying that discipline is love. Headed up to a Cavs game today, so I got my nerdy shirt on, right? And I just like the Cavs. Don't hate me, people, all right? But there's a player on the Cavs. His name is J.R. Smith, and it's taken me months to decide that I like this guy again because he played for the Knicks, and I'm just going to say the word. I hate the Knicks, right? I don't know how to make that nice. I hate the Knicks, and so yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know who's over there. I'm not even going to look at you, but as an Ohioan, I hate the Knicks. I hate everything they stand for. And if you play for the Knicks, I just don't like you, right? And so this guy gets traded from the Knicks to the Cavs. And for a while, I was like, can I trust this guy? Like, is he really in it for Ohio here? I don't know. And it took me like 3 alley-oops into the season. Like, there was one that made the Sports Center top play. And I was like, all right, I like this guy a lot, right? But I had to retrain my thinking and just say, like, you know, I didn't hate J.R. Smith. I just hated when his jersey said Knicks. I like this guy. I like this guy a lot. Here's why I like this guy. And I look at it from a new way. We have to retrain our thinking with discipline. Because we've been told, discipline is bad. Discipline means that someone hates you. And they're trying to ruin your life and trying to complicate your life. It means they've given up on you. And it means that they just want you to be embarrassed. And they don't want you to have any fun in life. And yet this passage is saying, retrain your thinking. Discipline equals love. Discipline is love. Not just that, but punishment. When I say the word punishment, does anyone else get nervous? Like, because I, even as I read this, I'm like, punishment? That seems terrible. Punishment equals acceptance and belonging. Discipline equals love, and punishment equals acceptance and belonging. And so if you're being disciplined, if God is speaking discipline into your life, if he's beginning to change your heart or make it very obvious that you need to change something in your life, if he's done that through a parent or through a sibling, if God in any way is putting discipline and boundaries and punishment in your life, if he's ended a relationship, if he's ended a job, if he's beginning to change something or tweak something or transform you, that means that he loves you, and that means that he's accepted you, and that means that he has a plan for you, regardless of how you want to feel or how you want to react. We have to trust what Scripture tells us. Discipline equals love, and punishment equals acceptance and belonging. So it means that you're a loved, accepted, thought of, cared for, provided for child. You're a member of his family. Verse 7 says this, as you endure this divine discipline, remember that God is treating you as his own children. Who ever heard of a child who is never disciplined by his father? And so sometimes God just jumps into our life and he does stuff that we don't like. We applied for a job and it was a slam dunk, and they told us we were an early candidate. We were at the front of the line and we were going to get it, and there was going to be a pay raise and we were going to move and everything was great, and the job never came through. Maybe God's making it very clear. I didn't want you there. In fact, where that was going to take you is already a problem in your life. I'm going to pull your life back. I'm going to draw this back. And here's what I have for you. God jumps into the middle of our life and our business, and he said, here's where we're going. We don't like that he's kind of in our business, right? We don't like that he's saying, I want to remove that thing. I want to remove that relationship. I want to remove that distraction. We don't like that one bit. And yet this verse is saying that God treats us as his own children when that's happening. And that just means that he's our father. Probably everyone in here has been disciplined by a mother, a father, a grandparent, someone that raised them, someone that was active in your life, and someone that cared for you. We're not going to go around and tell stories, but some of you might tonight in your movement group. You can talk about the best whooping you got as a child, right? You can talk about those things, but we know that when someone disciplines us, they love us. In the back of our mind, we can believe that. Sometimes we have to train our minds, retrain our minds to believe that when it comes to God. Verse 8 says this, if God doesn't discipline you as he does all of his children, it means you are illegitimate and you are not really his children at all. An illegitimate child is an unrecognized child, and a child that's not claimed. And God is saying, I claim you, I love you, I have a plan for you. And that means that there might be a time that you go outside of the boundaries or outside of the plan that I have for you, and I might have to steer you back in. And it might be painful, it might be awkward, it might be insulting, it might be embarrassing, it might feel all of those ways, but you have to trust and you have to know that discipline equals love, that my discipline equals love, and that my punishment of the way you're going is really my acceptance, and it's really you belonging in my family and you belonging in my heart and in my life. A lot of us in this room have played sports. You ever have a coach that said, don't get scared when I yell at you. Get scared when I stop yelling at you. Maybe I just grew up where coaches like to say that a lot. I don't know. But they would always say that, right? They'd say, if I stop yelling at you, it means I've given up on you. It means I don't believe in you anymore. It means that I don't care about you. My coach liked to yell at me. I think that means he loved me. That's what this passage is telling me. But I'm going to call him this week just to make sure, because I still feel like this weird tension between us. But if you're being disciplined, you're being loved. And if you're being punished, you're feeling accepted. Verse 9 says this, since we respected our earthly fathers who disciplined us, shouldn't we submit even more to the discipline of the Father of our spirits? Live forever. Now that's kind of inferring or assuming some things. I don't know that all of us were pumped about the discipline of our fathers, right? In fact, I think even now some of us have parents speaking things into our lives and we're thinking like, yep, probably not going to listen to you. I don't want to end up anything like you. I look at your life, you've been making me mad since I was 14, I'm now 15, so I've decided that I hate you, right? Right? Some of us are thinking that. Some of us are thinking you've made me mad since I was 14 and now I'm 35, but I still resent you in some major ways. And so even though God might be using them to speak into our life, even though God might be using your sister who you don't like or who you've always felt like you were in this competition with to speak into your life, you don't see it as God's discipline. You don't see it as God speaking into your life. You see it as something that you can take light, something that you don't have to listen to. Yet God is steering your life. God is getting into your life and God is saying, this is what I have for you. This is what I want you to leave behind. This is the weight that I want you to throw off and this is how I want you to run after me. And I'm saying this because I love you. So it's saying, since we respected our earthly fathers who disciplined us, shouldn't we respect and listen to the discipline of God, our Father, even more? Verse 10, for our earthly fathers disciplined us for a few years, doing the best they knew how. But God's discipline is always good for us. Talk about retraining your thinking, right? God's discipline is always good for us. It doesn't say God's discipline is almost always good for us. God's discipline is pretty good idea most of the time. I mean, the guy made the world, right? It says God's discipline is always good for us. Always. We know what the word always means. All the time. God's discipline is always good for us. And so if God has jumped into your life and said, nope, we're not going there. I want you over here. No, not this career, not this relationship, not these people, not this hobby, not this thing with your spare time. This is where I'm taking you. This is where I want you to run. This is how I want you to run. And you've fought that. You've kind of rebelled against that. You've avoided that. You haven't wanted to think about that. You've even gotten mad at the people in your life who were a part of that. The people who brought it up, who suggested it, who confronted you, who had an intervention, whatever those people did, you're resenting them, and yet they're just representing and working for God. God's discipline and the way that he's steering your life and getting into your life is always right. God's discipline is always right. And yet that's the fundamental tension that we feel in our lives because we think that we're always right. Right? We think that we know what's best, and we have the best ideas, and we spend our time the best, and we do things just right. And our friends, we like them, but they're not as smart as us. And our family, not even close. And our neighbors, oh, have you met our neighbors? There's no way they could be doing it right because we do it right. And yet, if we're going to follow Jesus, we have to admit that his ways are always right, that his discipline, his structure, the way that he speaks into our lives is always right, is always good for us. Why is that? So that we might share in his holiness. God's discipline is always right, and it's not just there to embarrass us or to bother us or to make us constantly change our plans. It's there to make us more like Jesus. It's there to chisel off edges of our rough personality and of our ego and of our problems and of our sinful nature. It's there to change us and morph us and make us more like Jesus. We say that we want to follow Jesus, and yet sometimes following Jesus means that God's saying, this needs to change, and this needs to get out of the way, and this part of your life, this is not good. When God jumps into our life, when God disciplines us, when God changes us and transforms us, it makes us more holy. It lets us live a life after the example of Jesus. Verse 11 says this, "No discipline is enjoyable while it is happening." Duh, right? We know that. We know that because we already don't like discipline. Verse 11, "No discipline is enjoyable while it is happening. It's painful, but afterward there will be a peaceful harvest of right living for those who are trained in this way." We've been through college. We've been through a master's degree. Some of you have been through labor. Some of you have been through things that are not good, right? You've been through 2-a-days and 3-a-days for college sports, and you know that sometimes incorporating discipline and incorporating something into your life that you didn't want to be there is not fun. And yet, at the end of discipline, there's always a reward. Even if you don't get that job, The discipline of going through that may have made you a better person. Or the discipline of going through 2-a-days made you a better person, even if you didn't get to play on that team. There's always a reward at the end of discipline. And so God has a plan. God is working on our holiness. God is helping us run after Jesus. And there is a reward at the end of discipline. The reward is Jesus. If you've taken your eyes off of other things, if you've taken the weight and other things that distract you and keep you from running, and you've put your eyes on him, that is the reward. You may get the job also. You may end up marrying the girl. There might be something added to your life. There might be some value, but Jesus is the reward. He's the good thing. The pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, Jesus is the good thing, and discipline always results in a reward. And so this passage teaches us that God's discipline has purpose and proves his love. God's discipline has purpose in our lives and proves his love. Why is that a big deal? Because I don't think that we know that. I think that we intellectually know that, but I don't think we really know that. Because God is working in our lives, and God is changing our lives, and God is involved in our lives. And he's changing the course that we're on, and he's changing the things that we say and the places we can go and the things that we do. He's interfering, and he's embarrassing us, and he's challenging us, and he's questioning us because he wants what is best for us. And we push against that. We rebel against that. We buck against that because we don't want that. So we have to trust this, that God's discipline has purpose and proves his love. I love this last verse here, verse 12. It says this, "So take a new grip with your tired hands and strengthen your weak knees. Mark out a straight path for your feet so that those who are weak and lame will not fall but become strong." If in some way, because someone has spoken into our life, because someone has said something into our life, because God has made it clear, because God has said it himself to us and revealed that as we read his word, if you know that something needs to change, something needs to be taken away, something needs to be morphed a little bit, and a part of your life needs to change so that you can run after God, you need to do that. You need to make that change. My son started baseball in the last 2 weeks, and I try not to be the crazy dad, right? The one that like has a baseball or a bag of baseball and is like, hit this. And you know, it's like always working with them all the time and like 5 hours a day in the yard and like, we got to do that again. I'm not going to love you until you have a good swing. I try not to be that dad, but they say like, "Dad, can we go out in the yard and play baseball?" So we do, right? And I teach them how to hold a bat and we swing and stuff. And then we get to baseball practice like a day or two later, and they're like holding their hands backwards and they're swinging like this and stuff, and everyone's looking at me like, "What kind of dad are you?" Right? And I have that moment where I'm thinking like, I taught them how to hold their hands. I told them what they should do. I told them that you shouldn't be pivoting when you swing a bat, right? I told them that they're not left-handed, and then they walk up to the plate and the coach says, "Are you left-handed?" And Kanan says, "Yep." You know, and then they start lining him up and I'm like, "Try again, buddy, try again," right? I mean, I've said that to them. I've spoken that into their life. I've said, "Okay, you're right-handed and you're playing baseball, so you should hold your hands like this, and you should be ready, and you should watch the ball hit the bat, right? You track the ball as it comes in there and swing." And no, they forget all of this. But this passage is saying, if you know a change that needs to be made, if you know something that will make you more effective, something that will make you a better Christ follower, something that will help you run after him, then you need to make that change. You need to do that. That's his discipline in your life, and his discipline is always right, always correct, and always good. And sometimes that discipline comes to us through relationships. Comes to us because someone has spoken something into our life, or someone's example has shown us a way that we're lacking, and so we don't like that. We find it offensive, we find it embarrassing. But if you know that you need to get a new grip, that your hands are tired and the way you're doing things isn't going to work out long term, it's not going to help you run after Christ and keep your eyes on him, then change your grip. If you know that the way that you don't spend time with God every morning is leaving you worn out and tired at the end of the day, then change your grip and incorporate some discipline and spend time with God. Let him speak into your life through his word so that you can get through your day, so that you can get through your stress, so that you can get through your responsibilities, and you can be successful and you can be effective. And if you know that you need to do something to strengthen your knees so that you can stand up, so that you can be the leader that God has called you to be, then make that change. God's discipline is speaking into your life, and we run from that and we avoid that. There have been a few times in my life that I felt like God was saying, you need to step your game up. When we had our first child, I was just lazy. I don't even know how to say that and protect myself, right? I felt like I was just not pulling my weight as a parent. I felt like I was expecting Kristen to do a lot. And I had to tell myself, listen, when I get home from work, I'm still on the clock. God has called me to be a husband, called me to be a father. He's told me that I need to step up my game, and I need to minister first to my wife, right? And then to my family, and I need to do that because that's what he's called me to. And he was saying that. He was saying, change your attitude, change your perspective. I'm telling you this. I've told you this through people in many other ways, but now it's up to you to do that. Some of us in this room have been told things. We've been shown things. We feel God prompting us to do things, but we don't change our grip. We don't change the way we approach that. And so we're still weak. We're still failing, and we're still stressed out, and we're still running from what God has called us to do rather than running in the way that God has called us to run. So here's our simple application for the day. We have a great example before us of many believers whose faith has been incredible. We have the example of Jesus and the sacrifice that he paid by dying on the cross so that we could have life. And this life that we have in Jesus was made to be lived in an incredible way. We're not supposed to just stumble through life. We're supposed to run after Jesus and live for him and honor him to the best of our ability, to the way that he has called you, to the way that he's made you, to the way that he's programmed you, to the way that he's designed you. And so if you're an artist, you're supposed to be an incredible artist for Jesus. If you're a mother, you're supposed to be an incredible mother for Jesus. If you're a teacher, like we already talked about, you get the summers off and we all hate you, but you should have incredible summers for Jesus, right? Whatever God has put you in, you should be doing that for him, and you should be running after him, and you should be keeping your eyes on him. And if God has said, listen, this is a little discipline, this is a little punishment, this is a little change that needs to happen, this is something that needs to be done so that you can run after me, we need to listen to that. We need to change our grip. We need to make sure that we're letting God speak into our life and change us and transform us. And I'm not the Holy Spirit. I'm just a really good-looking redheaded guy. I almost said that with a straight face. I love this verse that Jalee read. Did you notice it said that God is our shade? I feel like every redhead in the room was like, amen. Like, that doesn't speak to you guys, but shade like really ministers to us pale people, right? But if you think that I'm trying to come up with something to make you feel guilty or say, I'm not. That's not my point today. My point is that God is speaking discipline into our lives, and a lot of us are running from his discipline. A lot of us are running from his recommendations. A lot of us are running from the way that he wants to transform us and change us and develop intimacy with us. So whatever he's put on your heart this morning, I hope that you'll respond to that. I hope that you'll take that serious. I hope that you won't take that light, and I hope that you won't let that beat you down. I hope that you will respond to that and say, God, I'm listening, and I want to run after you. I want to make these changes. I want to live for you. I want to accept your discipline. I want to know that that's love. I want to be the best me that I can be, and I want to strip off this weight as I run after you. Pray that you'll make a change in your life and that you'll share that with someone in your life. Share that in the group that you're in. Share that with someone that you're here today with. If God has put something on your heart, something that needs to change, something that needs to be stripped off so that you can run after him, change your grip, change your approach. Let that change your life. Will you pray with me? God, thanks for today. Thanks for your word. Thank you for Hebrews and for the example it is. And Lord, I pray that that we will not run from the correction and discipline and punishment and things that we often think of as being bad. Lord, ways that you speak into our life and into our heart. I pray that we will be excited about what you're doing. I pray that we will be humble about what you're doing. And I pray that we will be accepting of what you're doing, because we know that you are always loving, always correct, and always have our best interest at heart. Lord, even when you speak into our lives through family and through people, Lord, help us to understand that we're really submitting to you, we're really following you. And Lord, we want to run after you. You sent your son Jesus to die for us so that we could know you and so that we could have life. God, help us to live that life to the fullest. And if that means making changes, if that means accepting your discipline, help us to be humble and do just that. God, help us to think through some things that you put in our heart as we sing and as we worship to you now, Lord. It's in your name I pray. Amen.